Welcome. This is your host, the man in jeans, here again to take you on a tour through another room in the House of Hammer. Riddle me re, dear listeners. What does one get when one crosses a star of the Carry On movies, a diabolical mother-in-law, and a sinister house? Yes, correct. You get the sitcom Terry and June. But what do you get if you cross a different star of the Carry On movies with a diabolical mother-in-law, a sinister house, and death by yoga? Well then, my friends, you get 1950s The Man in Black, Hammer's first movie of the 1950s, a decade that was to prove to be Hammer's most formative. Yes, folks, the 1950s is where the fun really begins, and by the time we get to the end of them, Messrs. Cushing and Lee will have begun to appear, and so will the characters of Dracula and Frankenstein. So hold on tight, we are slowly getting there. And mentioning those films at the outset of this episode is particularly apt. The Hammer horror films are what the studio is renowned for, and while we have seen hints of horror in the films we've covered so far, today's subject, The Man in Black, could arguably be said to display the first real blueprints of the Hammer formula. Firstly, the story is remarkably similar in tone to the Hammer horrors. The direction has that certain Hammer aesthetic to it. We get a rather grisly murder, complete with gushing blood and open wounds. Shocking for the time, really. We also get a pursuit through the trees that harks forward to all of those maidens being pursued through forests in future Hammer hits. And most notably of all, The Man in Black contains our very first glimpse of that most revered of Hammer locations, the distinctive architecture and Gothic stylings of Oakley Court in the parish of Bray, Berkshire, so not a million miles away from where I live. The house would end up in a cluster of Hammer horror films, as well as some other classics. If you're a Hammer fan, then you will know Oakley Court very well. And for those of you who might need a reminder about this true Hammer hero, here to tell you all about it is Smokey. Just Smokey. Like Fergie. Except that Smokey has no plans to go to America in the near future.
For lovers of Hammer like us, and one can assume you as well, I mean, I'm sure it's not our raw animal magnetism that brings you here every episode. The name of Oakley Court is, it could be argued, as synonymous with Hammer productions as, say, Bray Studios, or Peter Cushing, and Christopher Lee, Heaving Bosoms, and Luminous Red Blood. Okay, maybe not the last two. They're just synonymous with my nightly flights of fancy. But the marvellous mansion that still resides in the gorgeous surroundings of Bray, in the county of Berkshire, will forever be intrinsically linked with our favourite little movie studio with big ideas. Before we get there, though, I'd like to invite you to journey back in time with me. Do you want to? Come on, then. We're travelling all the way back to those heady days of 2021, where anything seemed possible, the air smelled so much sweeter, the unending sense of doom wasn't hanging over our heads, and where everything I just said was complete and total lie. What it was, though, however, was the setting for the House of Hammer summer meetup. Your four intrepid hosts took it upon themselves to do a mini Hammer tour, if you will. We visited Black Park, notable for its use in The Curse of Frankenstein, The Brides of Dracula, and of course, Wombling Free. We got turned away at the gate of Bray Studios, the home of Hammer since the 50s, by a little bloke in a high-vis jacket. And of course, we also wanted to see Oakley Court. Upon our arrival, down the frankly very impressive driveway, we spy a security guard and decide that one of us should be tasked with inquiring if us four lunatics would be able to have a little look around and take a couple of quick pictures. Said inquiry, it was quickly agreed upon, would be made by Adam. Now, don't look at me like that, alright? We all know why. I mean, fine, not to put too fine a point on it. He has a better cadence than we do. He speaks the lingo down there. Alright, fine. He's a posh boy who A. doesn't sound like he's from Doncaster, B. wasn't wearing an Iron Maiden hoodie, and C. had made the stunningly correct choice of not venturing out that day in a ridiculous, ridiculous pair of shorts. Anyway, permission was granted, and a brief walk around was had, a couple of snappy snaps were clicked, and we were on our way. While there, you don't really take in the full scale of the place. Oakley Court is classed as a Victorian Gothic country house. Basically, that means it's old, and it's f***ing massive. It's situated only an hour outside of London, and it sits in an area that's 35 acres wide. These days, it's a very plush hotel. God knows what they thought when they saw us lot on their grounds. I mean, we certainly don't look like the type that could afford even their cheapest nightly stay. But back in 1949, it became home for Hammer filming. Not only was it the location for this episode's film, The Man in Black, but also for our forthcoming episode, The Lady Craved Excitement. While only 5 Hammer movies were made in Oakley Court, the exteriors continued to be used over the years. It can easily be spotted in The Reptile and The Plague of the Zombies. Also, not a Hammer film by any stretch, but it also played home to Dr. Frankenfurter, the sweet transvestite himself, in the 1975 bat-crazy musical The Rocky Horror Picture Show, where, famously, because of falling into such disrepair, and the small fact that it had no heating and massive holes in the ceiling, one of the stars of said movie, a Miss Susan Sarandon, caught pneumonia while filming. As previously mentioned, Oakley Court is now a very swanky hotel, which has played host to Monsieur le Président de Gaulle, but also Her Royal Highness, Queen Elizabeth II, or Lizzie, as she's told us to call her. So, a lot has changed since its foundations were laid in 1859, and it passed hands betwixt knighted dignitaries, lords of the realm, and noted landowners. But if you are able to visit, or even just look up pictures of the old place online, the spirit of Hammer is still there. There may be no creaking gates, no Gothic towers, and no shuttered windows, but the air of something special definitely lingers. And who knows, if you're lucky, if you're very, very lucky, you may just catch a sight of 4 spectral figures muttering something along the lines of, "Oh, you go, Adam, you've got the best chance of getting us in."
Thank you, Smokey, and for anyone who desires to see all 4 of us in our glory, framed by the majestic outline of Oakley Court, check out the banner picture on our Twitter profile. By the way, before we move on, why not head on over to our Twitter right now and follow us at HouseHammerPod. Not only do we plant a tree in your honour every time someone follows us, we also use our Twitter account to supply you with all sorts of useful things, such as game pieces for our PC49 quiz a while back, links to the movies we review so that you can watch for yourselves, and all manner of other invaluable things that I can't think of right now. In fact, this very week, we have tweeted out a link so that you can hop on over and watch 1950's The Man in Black for yourselves. And it might be wise at this point to advise that you do so before our round table discussion later, as it's kind of impossible to talk about this film without going into spoiler territory. So if you haven't yet, head on over to Twitter and follow us at HouseHammerPod and check out the film for yourselves. Now, many of you might be wondering exactly who the Man in Black is, and why Hammer decided to devote an entire film to him. Well, as with most of Hammer's screen outings up until now, the Man in Black began life on radio. In fact, it could be said that the seed that grew into the Man in Black came from another aristocrat of British cinema.
This is Hollywood, and CBS presenting Forecast Number 4. Herbert Marshall, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, in the first program of a proposed new series entitled Suspense.
You see, all the way back in 1940, while promoting his new film, Foreign Correspondent, Alfred Hitchcock was offered the chance to devise his very own radio show in America. As the master of suspense, he devised a format where spine-chilling mysteries and adventures could be retold weekly in half-hour slots, and all designed to elicit that most prized of sensations when you're a filmmaker, the element of suspense. Hitchcock was far too busy to create the thing himself, but the idea was picked up by CBS and turned into one of the most well-remembered and regarded examples of radio drama, suspense. Leading mystery writers of the day, including John Dixon Carr, the eminent mystery author, turned in masterfully crafted half-hour thrillers of such quality that Suspense ended up producing 946 episodes, running from June 1942 to September 1962, ending its life on radio as one of the most outstanding productions to ever air on the medium. One of its most distinctive features, though, was that each episode was introduced by an enigmatic figure known as the Man in Black, played by Joseph Kearns.
This is the Man in Black, here to introduce Columbia's program, Suspense. In Hollywood this evening, our two distinguished stars are the lovely actress Margot and the polished young actor from Holland, Mr. Philip Dorn. A story by John Dixon Carr dealing with strange, very strange happenings aboard an ocean liner and called Cabin B-13 is tonight's tale of suspense.
Well, in 1943, the show was transferred to Britain and given the new name of Appointment with Fear. The format was kept very much the same, even down to the distinctive chiming bells and sinister melody. And the Man in Black was played by someone you will already be familiar with. Dr. Morell himself, Mr. Valentine Dial.
Appointment with Fear. This is your storyteller, the Man in Black. Here again to bring you another placid evening in our Farside series, Appointment with Fear.
Appointment with Fear would end up running for 10 series between 1943 and 1976. It was a huge, huge success here. The character of the Man in Black was also resurrected in 1988 for BBC Radio, played this time by Edward D'Souza. As recently as 2009, the character was again revived and played this time by Mark Gatiss. Well, in 1950, Hammer decided that the Man in Black might be worth bringing to the screen and so devised a very clever way of having him introduce a spine-chilling thriller very much in line with the kind of stories being told on radio.
This is your storyteller, the Man in Black. You are going to hear a story of intrigue and jealousy and murder. This is Henry Clavering, a man obsessed with the fear of impending death. Bertha, Clavering's second wife, merciless, vindictive, scheming. Janice, her daughter. Victor Harrington, the opportunist. Joan Clavering. Danger stalked her in this house of terror.
The story tells of Henry Clavering, played by Sid James, a wealthy yoga fanatic who's being slowly swindled of his fortune by his scheming second wife, Bertha, played by Betty Ann Davis, and her daughter Janice, played by Sheila Burrell. During a particularly dangerous exhibition of deep trance yoga, Henry is killed, leaving his fortune to his young daughter Joan, played by Hazel Penwarden, who soon finds herself being menaced by the occupants of the sinister old house she's inherited, including Bertha, Janice, and their rakish sleazeball of a guest, Victor, played by Anthony Forward. The only person on Joan's side is the grouchy old groundsman, who seems to have a secret or two of his own tucked away somewhere, and some presence just beyond their understanding. A voice from beyond the grave, perhaps? Could it be that the house contains restless spirits trying to make contact? But before we jump into our breakdown of The Man in Black, I know what you're thinking. Sid James? In a Hammer movie? Could it be so?
Our journey through the House of Hammer has thrown up some surprises so far, and then there's this one. Sid James. You know, the guy with that laugh. Who once said, "A face like mine grows on people, like a carbuncle." That's Sid James. I never expected us to be covering his career, but here we are. Born Solomon Joel Cohen on the 8th of May 1913 to a showbiz family, it was only a matter of time before he would make his stage debut, which he did at the age of 10. He would later change his name to Sidney Joel Cohen before finally settling on Sid James, or Sidney if he was in trouble. During his formative years in Johannesburg, away from the stage, he had an interesting cocktail of occupations, including dockhand, diamond polisher, dance tutor, fairground boxer, and coal heaver, whatever that is. And this was all before settling down with his first wife, Bertha Sadie, their daughter, and their own hairdressing salon in 1936. This wasn't going to last though, and within a year, he'd joined the Johannesburg Rep, and within four, his first divorce. Due to his undisputed talent on stage as a serious actor, it wasn't long before he was getting work in all the right places. His rise to fame was to be cut short though, when he signed up and served as a lieutenant in the South African Army. His job was organising the entertainment unit, sending shows and concert parties to entertain the troops fighting in the desert. He was part of the anti-tank regiment when he wasn't running rehearsals, and served in the fighting in the Middle East. On Christmas Day 1946, with enough money to buy a one-way ticket, he arrived in Britain with his second wife Meg, along with another daughter. To some, this would seem like a huge gamble, but Sid had a strong work ethic and rebooted his stage career within days.
Anyone ever give you a thicker, Nuxie?
Not without paying cash for it. You go home.
His rough and ready demeanour, the face a character actor would kill for, and that gravelly voice, made him a shoo-in for the wave of Brit noir and crime flicks that were popular until the late 50s. It was less than a year before he made his film debut in Black Memory. He'd already clocked up 11 screen credits, including two films for TV when he came to Hammer for the first time. I say for the first time, because his work on The Man in Black led to a further six jobs with the company. He turns up again as Carlo in the comedy The Lady Craved Excitement. Sharky, the shady boxing promoter in The Flanagan Boy, or Bad Blonde, depending on where you live. Another dead man walking in The House Across the Lake, or Heatwave. And then his last crime movie for Hammer, The Glass Cage, or The Glass Tomb in 1955, before he then goes on to play a reporter in the sci-fi Quatermass 2. And then finally, the comedy romp A Weekend with Lulu in 1961. By the time it came to him appearing in Quatermass 2, he was quite an established name after his work as a snake charmer on the Burt Lancaster film Trapeze. Filmed in France over a couple of weeks, he'd only taken the role for the Inland Revenue and his third wife Val and their two children. If ever you see the film, it's a testament to his talent, because you'd never guess he had a lifelong pathological fear and hatred of snakes. As well as his hard man roles, his comic timing had really started to be used to great effect as the morally ambiguous Sid in the Hancock's half-hour radio show that started in 1954. He made 102 episodes of this before moving to TV for another 55, which takes us into the 60s and his burgeoning carry-on fame. Before we leave Sid with his stardom secured and his unexpected career as a star of comedy booming, I was surprised to find that Disney had offered him a 9-month contract, which he declined in favour of staying where his heart was, with his family in Buckinghamshire. Breaking with the norm, Sid isn't so much a Hammer hero, more a hero and champion of British film in general. Not too shabby for a man who once said he was taught to read with a racing sheet.
Well then, gentlemen, here we are, our first film of 2022. And finally, we're into the year of 1950. Rejoice!
Yay!
We are out of... Thank you, Kev. Thank you. And yeah, you other buggers, you could have cheered. But anyway,
all right.
We are out of... That's all right. We're out of the 40s and we're into the 50s with our first film of the year, which is The Man in Black. Well, we have lots to go over here. Something of a darker turn for Hammer, I think we might agree.
Definitely.
I thought so, yeah. Not only do we have the first appearance of Mr. Sid James in a Hammer film, we also have a returning Anthony Forward, who was with us in Meet Simon Cherry, playing a slightly different character in this one, but we'll come back to that a little bit later. Adam, what are your thoughts about The Man in Black?
Man in Black, I saw this some time ago and been itching to get to this conversation with you for a while. I've said for a while, I don't think this is the greatest film that Hammer made, but I do think it's the first one where you can see clear blueprints of the Hammer horror formula, which I think is, you know, something we've been itching to see amongst us for a while. I mean, you've got Oakley Court, you have A Pursuit in the Dark, you have a rather grisly murder scene. The even the camera angles and everything, it's the first film, I have to say, from all of the films we've seen so far, where I've gone, ah, there it is. There's Hammer horror. Definitely. I don't think it's, don't get me wrong, I don't think it's up there with Celia or anything like that, but I do think they're finding their groove, and I think it's a rather delightful film.
Yeah, I'd agree with Adam. Some of the sort of hints towards the gothic are there, the setting, the feel of the film. I was a little bit, I don't want to use the word disappointed, but what I want to sort of maybe tap into is some of the expectations that our listeners might have of what you might have thought The Man in Black might be. And I was hoping it might be a sort of a haunting horror, a sort of a ghost story, if you like. And it's not. It's safe. It's playing, again, as Hammer have proved time and time again in the time we've been looking at them. It's playing to what was popular at the time, and it's more of a noir thriller. It does have a little bit of a hint of the paranormal in it, but I was a little bit sort of thrown off by what it turned out to be. That doesn't mean I was disappointed by it. It just means it wasn't quite what I was expecting.
To echo what you're saying there, I think it's useful to point out, which is that the title is very misleading. So I think that's where you're coming from, Ben, is that, so obviously, forgive me, but if you're literally throwing the opposite on it to The Woman in Black, which everyone will know, you get what the title says. In this, it's an introduction. And we've also spoken previously about Hammer being very, very savvy and very clever and taking up intellectual IP to use, because they can get it for cheap. People know the name. So here's guaranteed money, pretty much, really. And so they've obviously done this with The Man in Black. But The Man in Black has nothing to do with the story of the film. It's like an anthology, you know, Tales from the Crypt, Tales from the Dark Side, whatever you want, Twilight Zone, body bags, if you will. And it is just a way to lead into this story. So I think you're right, Ben. If you're going into this expecting a haunted mansion horror story with a man in black, then you are not, that this is not what you're going to get at all. So I think if you lower that expectation, then I think you'll be quite surprised by what you do get.
I was waiting for Johnny Cash to turn up for about 50 minutes before I realised that he's not going.
Someone had to say it. I do think we're looking at it through the lens of today instead of the lens of yesteryear. I do agree with you, Ben. I do think The Man in Black is an extraordinarily misleading title. But then again, when people saw that title back in the day, they were thinking, oh, it's a radio adaptation of that radio show, The Man in Black. That said, I do think you are completely correct in saying, I mean, even the poster is like a yellow poster with the man in black shadow. There's literally nothing to tell you what the film's going to be about. It's just, The Man in Black, obviously based on Appointment with Fear, which was the BBC radio series featuring The Man in Black. And it was just an anthology thriller series, which was in turn based upon Suspense, which was, you know, huge hit around the world, and introduced by The Man in Black. Man in Black's like a ubiquitous figure in anthology storytelling. He's the guy that turns up at the beginning of an episode and introduces a bit, and then you get a creepy story, and then he sort of outros you. But
you compared it to Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You know, he's not part of the story, but he turns up at the beginning and says, hi, you're about to be creeped out, makes a little joke, and then he's out of there for half an hour. But I do think this would have been better served with a hyphenated title. I do think knowing what it's about going in would have been a bit more helpful. That said, this is a very, very memorable film for me. It's one that I saw and was instantly struck by, not just because, as I say, the first glimpses of the Hammer formula, but there's lots in it that I just think stands up pretty well.
The other comparison I'd make would be sort of Elvira, Mistress of the Dark. You know, sort of that kind of leading you into a horror or a thriller. If we can just get stuck into the film a little bit. So we've got a scenario where we have the storyteller sort of preempts what's happening, and we have a chap who's very wealthy, who's dying, and has a second wife who maybe doesn't like him very much, and a stepdaughter who's the same, and he's very much into his yoga, which is not as we understand yoga today, I think it's fair to say, because for his evening's entertainment, the other members of his household, friends and family, are invited round to watch him not do a downward-facing dog, but to basically kill himself for their pleasure and bring himself back to life, which has ended.
We've all been to those parties where someone goes, you come around to see someone do a downward-facing dog.
Yeah.
That's the only reason we came to your house, Adam.
And you weren't disappointed.
No, we were not.
Sorry, go on, Ben.
But so yeah, he says, "Look, I'm gonna basically top myself, but then I'm gonna come back to life, and won't it be a fabulous evening? We'll have cocktails and enjoy it." And everyone's like,
"I know, right?"
Kind of, which is an odd. I found the whole yoga thing A, weird, and B, not as I understand yoga to be.
Tellies were expensive at the time, though, Ben. So you had to make your own experiment.
You had to cheer people up your own way.
Yes.
Yeah. But I actually think this is something you have to level again at what Adam said, which is that you have to, again, view it from a prism back then. So 1950, was yoga as well known as it is now? No. So it is this weird, mystical, foreign thing that is in this country. Look, Ben,
no,
you
I'm
can
just
shake
thinking,
your head
all
at me
I was
you
thinking
want,
was a bit
true.
Like hypnosis, a bit like what we saw earlier on. I wasn't disagreeing with you. I was shaking my head at the concept of yoga in the 1950s.
I know, but you literally just stole my point that I was going to make. Sorry. I was literally going to say about Dr. Morell and that that hypnotism that they trotted out in that. It's exactly the same with this as well. It's so like, okay, it's Eastern, it's mystical, it's unknown in this country. It could have been cannibalism. No, it couldn't. But you know what I mean? It could have just been something really weird.
Entirely different film.
Very different.
Oh, wouldn't that have been fantastic when they all sat around the table and Sid James is like
the man in black bean sauce.
Who's the roasted downward facing dog?
I love the fact that Ben stole your point, like Yoga Bear stole picnic baskets.
Oh, you did not just do that, pun.
No, I did. I did.
But also, but Ben's right, though. The fleshing out of this point is that, Sid James, his character, Henry, that was it. Henry knows he's dying. He is, he's trying to, basically trying to get himself well with yoga, isn't he? But there is this risk that if something occurs while he's doing this piece of yoga, that it could result in his instant death. Lo and behold, his second wife, the lovely, in inverted commas, Bertha, she knows what's going to cause his death, and so makes the catastrophic noise that, I love how he says, any noise could be fatal. And it's like, any noise. It's like, but you're still doing it in a room full of people? Okay, fair enough. All right, fair enough. Yeah. But so this is the basic premise, right? He's going to die. The scheming wife is going to end up with all his money. Job done. That's it, isn't it? I mean, that's the basic premise of the film.
You'd have been tempted to break wind and kill him just for the joy of the moment.
Wow, that was a killer fart.
This is what happens when you do yoga in Middlesbrough.
I think yoga anywhere. But as you say, it's a classic setup. It's you know, we have a sort of a spouse or a family member who is desperate for the inheritance, and they're prepared to do anything for it. And I don't think it's too spoiler territory to say that Sid James's yoga goes awry and he does not recover from his death pose. And it puts us into a gaslight type situation where Henry Claverley's daughter inherits all of his estate, and the stepmother and the ugly sister or stepsister are there to basically convince Henry's daughter, Joan, that she is going around the bend, because one of the sort of the facets of the will is that if she's unable to manage her own estate due to her mental instabilities or whatever the inappropriate term was in the will, they will inherit the estate. So what we get is a setup where they try to slowly drive her mad, and she is susceptible to their sort of their pretense. And it's for those of you who are familiar with Gaslight, the 1938 play, the 1940 British film, the 1944, I think, American remake, the difference with Gaslight is that we don't know the mystery. We don't know that it's the husband who's driving his wife around the bend. Here, we do know what is happening from the antagonist's point of view, and it makes for slightly less of suspense. And it's more of a drama, melodrama, because of it. And I would definitely chalk that, unfortunately, down as one of the points that made me enjoy this film perhaps less than some suspense films, because had we not known that Joan was being driven to insanity rather than us taking this journey with her, I think I would have enjoyed this film more.
Yeah, I do agree with you. But I also think that it sets its stall out from the opening seconds of this film. The Man in Black himself literally introduces each character. It's almost like a little cameo piece at the beginning where he says, "Here's the father, Henry Clavering," and you see a shot of Sid James, and he doesn't know what he's letting himself in for. He's a bit of a yoga. It tells you from the off that Bertha is a scheming wife, and that she's out to get his money and stuff. It's like, you know, here are the players. We're telling you now what their motivations are, because we want you to just go with these expectations in mind, that the whole film is built around a twist. The whole premise of this film is that a shock's going to happen later on in the film. But because it's so open with you at the beginning, it's a film that is predicated on the fact that a shocking thing will happen later. So it leads you down all the garden paths as obviously as it can, so that the twist just lands like a gut punch at the end. Have to say, I mean, we're going to have to go into spoiler territory at some point or another, because it's impossible to discuss this film without spoilers. So if you don't want to have this spoiled for you, I would say pause it right now. Go away and watch the film. It's freely available on YouTube, and we have supplied a link on Twitter. And then come back now, because I don't think we can really go any further with how successful this film is or how effective it is without spoiling it, unfortunately. So go away and watch it now, and we'll see you back here in about 5 seconds. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The whole film is predicated on the fact that Sid James can play multiple parts in this film. And I think, like God bless his heart.
Eddie Murphy of his day.
The thing is, we are watching this, like, it's just going to keep coming back. We're watching this through the lens of today, where Sid James is this cultural icon who's appeared in countless Carry On films, you know, all Bless This House and everything. Hancock's Half Hour. We know Sid James, and we know his voice. We know his face. So when he is trying to play a multiple part in the film, it's quite obvious that he is going to pop back up at the end. Plus, you know, all the plaudits and everything. I mean, he's great in this film. The problem is that the twist is kind of easy to spot, I think. But I think probably not for audiences of 1950 who weren't that familiar with Sid James at the time. You know, he was a new presence. Maybe they weren't looking out for it. But for people like us, I think you're going to be able to spot the twist in this film fairly early.
Yeah, well, as daft as it seems, even with the heavy makeup and what have you, and the crazy voice that he puts on that sounds like he's somewhere between Yarm and Tynemouth, it's a very
exactly
very
my thoughts. That was Kev. Yarm and Tynemouth.
Yeah,
literally to the letter. Those were my thoughts.
But was it just me that felt like the gaslighting wasn't really that effective? Because I mean, obviously, we're all quite familiar with Gaslight, the play, and I'm familiar with a lot of gaslighting subplots in giallo films, for instance. But here, it's basically just them tapping at the window every now and again when she's trying to get to sleep. That's more like
it worked, though.
It's like sleep deprivation more than anything else, I think.
Yeah, well, that's what they use in Guantanamo Bay. What do you want?
Maybe this is where they got their ideas from then. I don't know.
Maybe so.
It's like Gaslight Light, you might say, Kev.
Hey.
Nice.
Hey.
Gas
even lighter.
But what I would say is, I don't disagree. I thought that, in the film there is, you know, this pre-plot that Joan has nerves or suffers from a nervous disposition, which makes her slightly more susceptible, you know, to being persuaded that she's going sort of round the bend. Mm. But what I would say about the whole sort of Sid James angle is that, I'll be honest, At first, I didn't realise that that Henry Cleverly and Hudson were both being played by him. Genuinely didn't pick that up until a certain amount of the way through the film, where it became apparent. Yes, I would say it became apparent to me that there was only one way out of this, and it had to be that mustachioed Navy man who was quite prevalent in the film.
Oh, go in, I should go.
It must be that, you know, that is the reason that we come to some kind of resolution at the end. But what I would say about Sid James is, though, that he is playing the father of a girl who must be 20, and Sid James is playing a part who must be what, meant to be in his 50s. Sid James is 37 years old in this film. He is 37, and he looks like my granddad.
Look, story aside, the story's really good. I do really enjoy the story. So you have this guy who's obsessed with yoga. He's dying. He like lays all these clues and Easter eggs about how he's going to perform this trance thing. And if anyone makes a noise, he'll die. So, of course, a noise happens and he dies. And then it becomes this story about, you know, his daughter inheriting everything and being gaslit by the stepmother and her daughter who want the fortune. Then this, like, loush boyfriend of the stepdaughter turns up. And it becomes a bit more complicated. Like, you know, he tried to romance Joan. But the mother and the stepdaughter are kind of like, no, you can't have it. And it's like a bit of a power play between them. The second act of this film is quite weak, I would say. It starts off like, ooh, what's happening here? And the third act is like all kinds of great, but the second act, I think, is kind of weak. Also, I don't think Bertha is the greatest villain of all time. Like, her plan to gaslight Joan, as you say, consists of just like, you know, opening a door and then closing it again. And then going, oh, I think your dad's watching you. Really? Yeah, I think he is, yeah. She's not the greatest villain, but she's played very well. Not the greatest villain. Also, as well, I found the whole scene where she gives her plot away to the lawyer about halfway through, like, really stupid. It's like she gets the lawyer and she says, but what would happen if, I proved her to be mad, you know? Well, you have to prove her to be mad by medical. What if I just say she's mad, though? Will I be able to get the fortune? I'm going to leave now, says the lawyer. She's like, you're like, dude, why are you saying this to the lawyer?
Dude,
stop it, dude. So, yeah, I mean, there are a ton of problems in this film. My love for this film comes mainly through, I think Sid James is great. I think the daughter, Joan, I think she's great in this. She's absolutely beautiful. I can't believe she wasn't in more movies. And I do think, no matter what you think about the plot of the film, the blueprints of Hammer horror are definitely here. There's a scene where Joan is being pursued down Oakley Court Drive, and when you see it happen, you know, she's walking down past the trees and she's glancing over her shoulder and you hear these footsteps behind her. And all I was thinking was that this is just like, you know, all of those scenes at Black Lake where, you know, the characters are being pursued through the woods. There's another scene where a certain character is murdered halfway through, which is surprisingly grisly. Mm. He's beaten to death and there is blood. I mean, there's blood. There are wounds, open wounds. And
face spurting.
Like, wowza. Face spurting.
Yes.
Is a very apt description. It's really kind of
the
like
the man in black presents face spurting.
There's your title.
Yep.
If this thing had been in Technicolor, I think you would instantly say that's a Hammer shot, definitely. Yeah. Also, there are it's filmed in Oakley Court. It's on location as well. So you get lots of shots of Oakley Court, Plague of the Zombies and all that kind of thing. And we were lucky enough to go to Oakley Court last year. Well, you know, Oakley Court. We didn't get to Hammer Studios, but we went to Oakley Court and I went into the lobby and spoke to someone and said, is it okay if we come in and take some pictures and stuff? And he was like, yeah, of course you can, of course you can, of course you can. And when I went into Oakley Court, when I watched The Man in Black, the first thing I thought was, wow, I know that staircase. I know that doorway. I know that room. I was stood in that room talking to that guy. So it's obvious that, you know, this is the beginning of the Hammer formula.
I'm glad you said that, though, Adam, because I'm glad I'm not alone in that I thought that there were some problems with the second act. So we do have Janice and we have Victor. We have the daughter of Bertha and we have a betrothed. And it seemed to me that that was the weakest part of the film. It was that they instantly didn't seem to like each other very much anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, he had a wandering eye straight away as soon as he saw Joan. And by the way, you've got to love that shot when he pulls up to the front of Oakley Court and his car was just out there, and obviously Hodson's there as well. That I love that shot. It was great.
Yep.
But as I said, this is Anthony Forward, who we've met before in Meet Simon Cherry. And he was in that film, but in this one, he's a
Don't you think it kind of suits it though, Smoke? Not to derail your point, but they're a nest of rotters. That's what I love.
Yeah, this is brilliant. I mean, I mean, I know how you said that Bertha wasn't the greatest villain, but
she's very clever.
No, she's not at all. But she's horrible.
Yeah, she's horrible. But her plan's rubbish, and she's not very good at her plan, which is rubbish.
Yes. No, I completely agree. I completely agree. But my point is that this conceit is the weakest part of the film. Mm. I mean, it's not even a love triangle, is it? It's a hate triangle between Janice, Victor, and Joan. And it never rings true. Maybe because of the runtime, because it's so quick. Mm. But it was just sort of there. Maybe he's just a cad and it's just showing him being that way. But for me, yeah, this again, as you say, added to the fact that this isn't the strongest part of the film. It just kind of laid down a little bit. And as you say, during this part, nothing really happens very much.
Mm. Apart from Bertha getting the really good line that she says to Joan, where it's something like, don't give that active little brain too much to do. It's bad for you. Which, again...
That's brilliant.
Bertha is just an absolute nightmare of a woman.
But she is horrible.
I do want to say that they all look incredible, but you can actually distinguish each character. All three of the women in this have a very striking look. Bertha especially, I mean, she comes off looking a bit like Cruella de Vil at half the time.
Mm. Yeah, 100%.
There is some insane stuff on this. But the crazy hairstyles, yeah, definitely. And then you've got Joan that wanders around with a nightie on and black gloves, which is an odd kind of sartorial choice.
It's a fantastic choice.
But it's great when it does start to ramp up and you don't realise at the time that Joan's actually in on it and knows what's going off, because there's a bit where Bertha, obviously bringing in her crazy psychic powers, she says, your father was trying to contact me last night from the other side. And then, of course, Joan just goes, was he in good health? And you think...
You got the measles.
You know what dead means.
A bit of COVID.
Yeah. But it works out, though. I mean, especially what Ben said in a previous episode, which was how... I mean, fair play to Ben. He was rather cruel to you, Kev. And I won't put that on him too much. No. But saying how easy engagement was back in the day, it was just sort of like, you know, I think this film heard you, Ben, because at one point, Victor does go up to Joan and sort of says, I think we should get married. And she says, I've only known you 5 minutes.
Yes.
And thankfully...
Refreshing, isn't
this
it?
This is the first time in all of these films that we've watched so far where someone has gone, no.
After knowing them for 41 minutes.
Yeah, 100%, absolutely brilliant.
He did have the personality and she had the wealth. So, you mm-hmm. know, what a perfect pair.
It just makes me...
Hang on. He had a personality?
Well, apparently. He was selling himself that way.
Well, that's true.
Slugger.
It just makes me glad I wasn't a wealthy landowner in the early 20th century because there'd be someone living in my house, fishing in my pond, and trying to shag my daughter.
Weekly.
That's the three worst things about being a landowner.
Especially in a pond.
Okay. All right, my friends. I think we've done this pretty well. So we'll go around you all as we normally do and take your ratings. But I would like to ask you a question. Regardless of how much you respect this movie, Adam has made his feelings very well known, and Ben and Kevin and myself will make ours more known as we come along in the next couple of minutes. However, I would like to... There's a either-or question coming here. So if you could choose one thing to improve this film, would it be to add a more supernatural element to it? Or, and this is just for Kev, would you like to add a more killy element to it? So, there we go. So, Ben, we'll start with you. Your rating and, what would you add to this and your overall thoughts to the film?
I'm going to give it a 6 out of 10. I was a little bit disappointed by it. It was, I don't think it deserves... The as we talked about before, the sort of the title and the Valentine Dial introduction, that the story itself is quite weak. I did enjoy it, you know, hence my sort of slightly positive rating. I'd love to say that I thought the film would benefit from a slightly more paranormal feel, but I honestly don't think that would fit this. So I guess I'd go for the sort of slightly more murderous tone. But again, you know, we're looking at a limited number of characters, so it isn't really going to work that way. I don't know really how I would improve it other than not having this story as the Man in Black story. It was okay, though. I mean, I think okay is the byword for me here. 6 out of 10. Yeah, it was all right.
Rightio. Thank you. Adam?
Well, I would give this 7 out of 10. I don't think it's perfect at all. But further to what you've said, Smokey, I think you've took the Man in Black element away from it. I think this could have been called something else, like Ben said. I think you could have called this, you know, the yoga murder or something, the yoga, you know, whatever, at the house. So I don't think that doesn't really lose a point for me, but I do get what you're saying about, you know, there's literally no reason for this to be the Man in Black, the movie, because there's nothing to that element of it. But I do think it's important because it kicks off the 50s, which is the decade in which Hammer Horror arrives later on. You know, lots of other stuff happens. I think this is an important film. I don't think it's a great film in terms of quality, but I do think it's an important film in terms of stylistic positioning, I would say. I think from here on out, you can really see Hammer Studios in the films. Never more evident than this one. I think this is literally where you will look at it and go, that's a Hammer film. You know, the Hammer logo is all over the end of it, the old thing. The shadows are all there, the camera shots are there, the Oakley Court's there, the blood is there. So yeah, I do think it's important in that kind of respect. That said, you know, I mean, it's not the best film we've seen so far, and it's certainly not the best film of what we're going to see in the next few shows. But I do think it's a pivotal, it's a keystone moment in the Hammer legacy. So yeah, 7 out of 10. And whether I would say it needed more killy or more supernatural, I can't really. I mean, the whole thing predicates around a twist, so. Oh, God, it's really difficult to say. More killing would have been great. Yeah, and more supernatural thing. The whole thing turns out to have been not supernatural at all. So that's kind of the point of it. But yeah, more killing would have been great. Thank you.
Excellent. I do like the fact though that you just said that, you know, we're in the 50s now, and this is when we're really going to get to the Hammer Horror. And I'm thinking, yeah, for us, it's the 2050s. That's when we're going to get to the proper Hammer Horror.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it does kind of match up. I'll go next. I'll only be very brief. I'm going to rate it slightly higher. It surprised me. I'm going to rate it an 8 out of 10. I really enjoyed it. More so on the second viewing. The first viewing I thought was slightly ploddy, and then I kept seeing bits on the second viewing that I didn't sort of that didn't register before, and I enjoyed that. But also a little behind the curtain here for you, for all of you, in fact, is that I skipped Valentine Dial's bit on the second viewing. I watched it as a standalone piece without his introduction, which I felt like a radio play. You know what, like your suspense plays, Adam, you know, it's when they introduce your characters and give you a little bit of backstory. I didn't need that. I wanted it straight from the off and just took it as a standalone play, basically. And I enjoyed it more that way.
That is one of the criticisms I've seen, Smokey, is that it watches like it should have been a radio play.
A film of its own. You know, it sort of, a film on its own.
It might have been even the exact same plot might have been slightly more impactful as a radio play, and maybe the transition from one medium to another didn't work.
That's exactly the way I viewed it. So I did. I cut off Valentine Dial's bit. And I've got no problem with Valentine Dial, but this film lent itself more to being a standalone piece. And as Adam mentioned, an additional title like we've had before, you know, like with Celia and with PC-49 and whatnot, and it would have worked a lot better than just calling it The Man in Black. But no, it's an 8 out of 10 for me. I really enjoyed it. As you say, it's not the best film we've seen so far, but I did enjoy it. I'm going to have to go for the Killy angle as well. Let's kill more people. This would have been, just kill more people. That would have been fine. Janice, she deserved to go in some way, you know. Do it right at the end. When she gets shocked, she could have got shocked to death. You know, a bit like Dear Bleak. End it like that, you know. Bang, dead, gone. You know, that would have been fantastic.
The more I think about it, Janice is actually a character that didn't need to be there at all. Like,
but she's so horrible that she makes it work.
Well, I mean, literally, she's just like Bertha's sidekick. She doesn't add anything to the story apart from being, you know, Matey's girlfriend.
Yeah, but Janice is there just for the jealousy angle. So that she's got, then you've got a reason for Victor to be there as well. That's right, all she's there for, really.
Literally, isn't it?
Also, I'll add one more, is that you said yourself that that Bertha is such a terrible villain that she did need a sidekick. So, you know, a little bit of help back there. But anyway, that's my response. Kevy, how about you, my friend?
Well, I think The Man in Black is a very handsome film. It looks great. The cast looked great, the costumes, the hair, everything.
Oh, the score was great as well.
Yes, yeah. Again, it's our friend Frank Spencer.
Betty, yeah.
That's never going to get old.
Every time, every time.
But yeah, it loses a couple of points for me because it felt like it's another Cluedo film. Very much a potted thing, you know, and I'm getting a bit tired of these mansion things. I just want to get out a little bit more. But there was a great shot where it opens with Valentine Dial just dragging on a fag, and you think, great, it's another one where we're going to have loads of smoking, and your opening scene is smoke. And then it cuts to Bertha and Janice, and they're both having a fag as well. In fact, Janice seems to constantly have one on the go, apart from when she's trying to look shocked. But yeah, it's got some good fun stuff in this. I would give it a 7. Originally, I'd give it a 5 because I just didn't know what I was going to expect, but it certainly wasn't this. But it was interesting to see split screen for the first time in a Hammer film as well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Well,
that's the first time I've seen that. Yeah. It was pretty obvious what they were doing, but yeah, it works fine. But for me, the real mystery of the film is whatever happened to that 18-foot painting of Sid James? Do you reckon he took it home with him?
Oh my God, I hope so.
It got sent to her husband. That's what happens right at the end of the film.
Oh, I know, but I want to know what happened to the real painting.
What happens in real life?
Oh, you want the real one?
Yes, I want that painting.
Did none of you think that it looked like Harry Enfield playing Grayson in the Mr. Chumley Warner? Mr. Chumley Warner.
I gather they now worship it in Sunderland as a deity.
It's brilliant.
So, Kevy, Supernatural or Killy?
I would go Supernatural because if you go Killy, you're only going to be killing the help because there's only really Elsie, the Doctor, Mrs. Carter, and then you're really starting to run out of people. So I would have...
No, I said kill Janice. She deserves to die.
Oh, yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Please don't.
Once she's done a jealousy bit, I suppose you could kill Janice. Yeah, fine. But you could have had a ghostly Hodson, for instance, just floating about the lake in his boat.
That'd have been good.
Ooh, nice. Yeah.
Oh, go a bit Lady Macbeth on the end of it.
Oh, I just think it's Scooby-Doo.
Lady Macbeth.
It's Kev's level. Scooby-Doo.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's fine. I'm on board with Kev. And that's not a criticism, Kev. I'm with you.
No. Stop trying to smarten it up, Smokey. God damn it.
Sorry. Sorry, my fault. I've never been accused of that before on this show. Sorry, ever.
Enjoyed it. One last.
It did have the finest credit as well, which was House Coat by Jaeger. What? Who's house coat?
Next year, Kev, we'll all be wearing house coats by Jaeger.
Or black cardigans.
Sponsored by Jaeger.
Well, there you have it. The Man in Black, roundly admired by us all for different reasons, and I think the first movie that feels like the more traditional Hammer fare that we all grew up with. It's a film that I really do think that all Hammer horror completionists should check out, if only for the first glimpse of Oakley Court. Well, seeing as how today's episode is all about The Man in Black, and that particularly popular format that so enticed radio listeners, we thought we'd resurrect him one last time. Suspense and Appointment with Fear all employed the work of famous mystery and horror writers during their time on the air, and so, for one night only, this is your storyteller, the Man in Black, here again to welcome you into another chilling tale. All the way from 1894, and from the pen of Louisa Baldwin, a brief but black excursion into the unknown. Come, sit by the fireplace as Ben Taylorson tells you the eerie story of how he left the hotel.
Welcome. I am your storyteller, the man in the black cardigan. It was a Christmas present from my wife. It was grey, but I've dyed it. Anyway, our tale today is an adaptation of Louisa Baldwin's chilling short story, How He Left the Hotel. Allow me to read you an account of an eerie encounter in an elevator. I used to work the passenger lift in the Empire Hotel. I'd served my time in the army and got my discharge with good conduct stripes. That was how I got the job. The hotel was a big company affair, with a managing committee of retired officers and such like, gentlemen with a bit of money in the concern. My late colonel was one of them. He was a good-tempered man, so long as you didn't cross him, and when I asked him for a job, he said, "Maul, you're the very man to work the lift at our big hotel. Soldiers are civil and businesslike, and the public like 'em, only second best to sailors. We've had to give our last man the sack, so you can take his place." I liked my work well enough, and my pay. I kept the job for over a year, and I should have been there still if it hadn't been for the occurrence. But we'll get to that. It was a hydraulic lift I worked, not one of those rickety things. It ran as smooth as oil. A child might have worked it, and being in it was as safe as standing on the ground. Instead of being stuck full of advertisements like an omnibus, we had mirrors in it, and the ladies would look at themselves and pat their hair and set their mouths as I was taking them downstairs dressed for an evening. It was a little sitting room, with red velvet cushions to sit down on, and you'd do nothing but get in and I'd float you up or float you down, light as a bird. All the visitors used the lift at one time or another, going up or coming down. Some of them were French, and they'd called the lift the ascenseur, good enough for them in their language, no doubt. But why the Americans, who are always finding out ways of doing things quicker than other folks, should waste time and breath calling a lift an elevator, I could never make out. I was in charge of the lift from noon until midnight. By that time, the theatre and dining out folks had come in, and anyone returning late walked upstairs, for my day's work was done. One of the porters worked the lift till I come on duty in the morning, but before 12 there was nothing particular going on, and not much till 2 o'clock, really. Then it was pretty hot work, with visitors going up and down constantly, and the electric bell ringing you from one floor to another like a house on fire. Then came a quiet spell when dinner was on. I could sit down comfortable in the lift and read my paper. I wasn't allowed to smoke, though. No one was. I always noticed the faces of folks getting in the lift. I've got a sharp eye and a good memory for faces, and none of the visitors needed to tell me twice where to take them. I knew them all, and I knew their floor, as well as they did themselves. It was in November that Colonel Saxby came to the Empire Hotel. I noticed him particularly, because you could see at once he was a soldier. He was a tall, thin man, around 50, with a hawk nose, keen eyes, and a grey moustache. He had a stiff walk from a gunshot wound to his knee. But what I noticed most was the scar of a sabre cut across the right-hand side of his face. As he got into the lift to go to his room on the fourth floor, I thought what a difference there is amongst officers. Colonel Saxby put me in mind of a telegraph post for height and thinness, but my old colonel was like a barrel in uniform, but a brave soldier and a gentleman all the same. Colonel Saxby's room was number 410, just opposite the glass door leading to the lift, and every time I stopped on the fourth floor, number 410 stared me in the face. The colonel used to go up in the lift every day regular, though he never came down in it till that one night. But I'm coming to that presently. Sometimes, when he was alone in the lift, he'd speak to me. He'd ask me what regiment I'd served in, then he'd say he knew the officers in it. But I can't say he was comfortable to talk to. There was something standoff about him, and he always seemed deep in his own thoughts. He never sat down in the lift. Whenever it was empty or full, he stood bolt upright under the lamp, where the light fell on his pale face and scarred cheek. One day, in February, I didn't take the colonel up in the lift, and he was regular as clockwork, so I noticed it. But I supposed he'd gone away for a few days, and then I thought no more about it. Whenever I stopped on the fourth floor, the door of 410 was shut, and as he often left it open, I felt sure the colonel must be away. But at the end of the week, I heard a chambermaid say that Colonel Saxby was ill. So, I thinks, that's why he hasn't been in the lift lately. It was a Tuesday night, and I had an uncommonly busy time of it. It was one stream of traffic up and down the whole evening. It was on the stroke of midnight, and I was about to put the light in the lift out, lock the door, and leave the key in the office for the man in the morning, when the electric bell rang out, sharp. I looked at the dial and I saw it was the fourth floor. It struck 12 as I stepped into the lift, and as I passed the second and third floors, I wondered who it was that had rung so late. It must be a stranger that didn't know the rule of the house, I thought. But when I stopped at the fourth floor and flung open the lift doors, Colonel Saxby was standing there, wrapped in his military cloak. The door of his room was shut behind him, for I read the number on it. I thought he was still ill in bed, and ill enough he looked. What could a man that had been in bed a number of days want with going out on a winter's night? Anyway, he stepped into the lift, and I put it in motion. I looked at him standing under the lamp, with the shadow of his hat hiding his eyes, and the light full on the lower part of his face, a face that was deadly pale, and that scar on his cheek, showing paler. "Glad to see you better, sir," I said. But he said nothing. I didn't like to look at him again. He stood like a statue with his cloak about him, and I was downright glad when I opened the doors for the lift for him to step out into the hall. I saluted as he got out, and he went past me towards the front door. "The colonel wants to go out," I said to Joe the porter, who was stood staring. So he opened the door, and Colonel Saxby walked out into the snow. "That's strange," he said. "It is," said I. "I don't like the colonel's looks. He doesn't seem himself at all. He's ill enough to still be in his bed, but there he's gone out on a night like this." "Anyhow, he's got a good thick cloak on to keep him warm," I said. "Supposing he's gone to a fancy ball, and that cloak is there to hide the dress," said Joe, laughing uneasily, for we both felt more unsettled than we cared to say. As we spoke, there came a loud ring at the doorbell. "No more passengers for me," I said, and I really was putting the light out this time, when Joe opened the door and two gentlemen entered. I knew at a glance they were doctors. One was tall, the other was short and stout, and they both came up to the lift. "Sorry, gentlemen, but it's against the rule for anyone to go up after midnight." "Nonsense," said the stout gentleman. "It's just past 12, and this is a matter of life and death. Take us up to the fourth floor at once." They were in the lift like a shot, so up we went. And when I opened the door, they walked straight to number 410. To my surprise, a nurse came out of the door, and the stout doctor said, "No change for the worse, I hope." And I heard her reply, The patient. He died 5 minutes ago, sir. Though I'd no business to speak, it was more than I could stand to say nothing. I followed the doctors to the door and said, "There's some mistake here, gentlemen. I took the colonel down in the lift since the clock struck 12. He's gone out." The stout doctor said sharply, "A case of mistaken identity. It was someone else you took down, not the colonel." "Begging your pardon, gentlemen, but it was the colonel himself, and the night porter that opened the front door knew him as well. He was dressed for a night like this, with his cloak wrapped round him." "Well, step in and see for yourself," said the nurse. I followed the doctor into the room, and there lay Colonel Saxby, looking just as I'd seen him a few minutes before. But he lay there dead as his forefathers, and with that great cloak spread over him to keep him warm. I never slept that night. I sat up with Joe, expecting every minute to hear the colonel ring the front doorbell. Next day, every time the bell for the lift rang sharp and sudden, the sweat broke out on me and I shook. I felt as bad as the first time I did when I was in action. Me and Joe told the manager about it. He said we'd been dreaming, but he also said, "Mind you, don't talk about it, or the house will be empty in a week." The colonel's coffin was smuggled into the house the next night. Me and the manager and the undertaker's men took it up in the lift. It lay right across it with not an inch to spare. They carried it into room number 410 while I waited for them to come out again. A strange feeling came over me. When the door opened softly, four men carried out the long coffin, straight across the passage, and set it down with its foot towards the lift. The manager looked round for me. "I can't do it, sir," I said. "I can't take the colonel down again. I took him down at midnight yesterday and that was enough for me." "Push it in," said the manager, speaking short and sharp, and they ran the coffin into the lift without a sound. The manager got in last, and before he closed the doors he looked at me and said, "Mole, you've worked this lift for the last time, it strikes me." And I had. I wouldn't have stayed on at the Empire Hotel after what had happened. Not if they'd doubled my wages. In fact, me and the night porter left together that night, and we never returned. So, there you have it. The story of Colonel Saxby's last ride. Next time you find yourself in a lift with other passengers, pay close attention. If there's one who's pale, quiet, distant, and emits something of an uncanny aura, perhaps you found yourself in the company of the recently deceased. Or perhaps it's just Smokey.
Wonderful. That was Ben Taylorson with his retelling of How He Left the Hotel by Louisa Baldwin. That is all we have time for today. Thank you so much for joining us. Remember that if you'd like to stay in on the conversation, then you can follow us at House Hammer Pod on Twitter, at House Hammer Pod on Instagram. Or if you'd really like to let it all out, you can email us at scream@houseofhammerpodcast.com. So from myself, Adam Roach.
From me, Smokey.
From me, Ben Taylorson.
From me, Kev.
Welcome to Hammer Films of the 1950s, and welcome also to the new year, 2022. We have many rooms to explore here in the year ahead, so do make sure you arrive promptly for your next visit to the House of Hammer.